Hi, everybody. It's Mike. You're about to hear part one of a two-part interview that I did with Glenn Nelson about Gord's Gold, which was the compilation album that was released in 1975 and that included reworkings of about half the songs that appeared on the collection. That's album one of two. The justification given at the time was that Gordon didn't like listening to his early work. In any case, you're going to hear what Glenn and I have to say about some of those songs in this episode, and in a later episode, you'll hear us talking about the second half of that collection. So I hope you enjoy.
The first guest of the evening is truly a poet. He's an artist. He is a friend and an inspiration to anyone who I think who has ever played the guitar or tried to write poetry. Would you please welcome Gordon Lightfoot?
Welcome to Carefree Highway Revisited, the show that celebrates Gordon Lightfoot's music song by song, a proud member of the FM Podcast Network. I'm your host, Mike Messner, and with me today is a fellow Lightfoot fan from Keller, Texas, Glenn Nelson. Glenn, thank you for coming back on the show today.
You're welcome, Michael. Glad to be with you.
So what's new with you, Glenn? The last time you were on the show with us was in July of 2023. So is there any news in the world of Glenn Nelson since the last time we were together?
No, everything's gone real well for myself and family and my wife. We're enjoying retirement, continuing to collect records. Can you imagine that? Even after a long years of collecting, every now and then, you know, something will show up, even a Lightfoot album, that a Pickwick like that I didn't have. So that's going on. And then really enjoying, actually, on Facebook, there's a lot of music clubs. And you and I both, I know, enjoy a lot of the Gordon Lightfoot clubs. And especially Gord's Gold for me has been an interesting experiment. And so I bring some of the songs that I like into that club. And so continuing to just be a huge Lightfoot fan, and I know you are as well.
Oh, absolutely. And Facebook is the life and breath of this podcast, and it's always great to talk with people about the music, particularly in a setting that's so conducive to interaction like what Facebook has. But as you said, Gord's Gold is the name of a group on Facebook, and it's also the name of the album that we're going to be talking about today. For me, it is the definitive Gordon Lightfoot set. It's better than any greatest hits or any collection or best of that's come out since then. It was the very first thing I ever heard from Lightfoot. It was the only thing I heard from Lightfoot for a very long time because I got busy growing up and because I didn't develop an interest in folk music where I could actually do something about it and decide what I wanted to listen to until much later. It has most of his best songs up until the time that that collection came out. And it's written at what I think is his artistic and commercial peak, which is 1974 and 1975. So what's the impact of this album for you?
Well, you said it really well. It's similar for me. I think the difference would be my launch point was 1970 when I was in college, just starting college. And If You Could Read My Mind, the retitled album came out. And even though I had been up on the folk scene, the Brothers Four, Peter, Paul, and Mary, even listened to Ian and Sylvia, I think that the 1970 album started an era for Lightfoot that he really continued in the 70s, developing his signature sound. So when Gord's Gold came out, I bought the album thinking, wow, you know, I'm going to get the stuff from 70, 71, 72, 74 from Sundown. You know, I was just excited, like any greatest hits, you want to do that. I was in for a surprise, though. The ambition for Lightfoot to literally go back and record all of these great folk songs that he had done for United Artists, and most of which I was not that familiar with yet. So Gord's Gold was the impact that spurred me back to say, wait a minute, I haven't given Gordon Lightfoot his full due. I need to go back. And so it was a very strong influence on me to say, wow, this is not just one of seven artists that I like. This guy might be in the top three, you know, right in there. So once they get to that level, I start collecting everything that I can find.
Well, you know what? You said it so well also, Glenn. I think you said it even better than I did. And we know that the reason that Gordon recorded those songs on Album OM is that simply, as he said in his liner notes, he doesn't like listening to his early work. And there's certainly a lot of maturing that he had gone through in the preceding 10 years. So I understand the discomfort, and I think a lot of musicians do also. But you also brought up a good point that in 74, 75, Sundown had just come out. He's not at Summertime Dream quite yet, but it does beg the question, was this as much of a calculated move to put out the double album as it seemed? You alluded to the idea that these were from UA, so somebody might have been thinking, well, this would necessitate people going back and buying the old albums, which means there's going to be residuals there. So I'm wondering if you could talk about what the historical context of the double album was and maybe what the strategy had been from him up until that time.
Yeah, you know, I've been thinking about that question, not just because we were getting ready to go into Gord's Gold here, which that question begs to be asked and answered. But I think that I take away from what I read from Jennings on him and just knowing kind of what Gord did over the years of being so involved with the engineering and the recording. He got more and more involved each year, each album that went by. And I think that he probably wanted a shot at applying his newly found and fully developed skills to say, wait a minute, I wrote some great songs and I'm not sure that they were given their full due when I recorded them. You know, I know he hesitates to listen to the, or did hesitate to listen to the UA recordings, but my goodness, his voice was great. And for the period, it was classic folk. So, you know, we would all, to me, if I could have produced something like that, you know, obviously I wouldn't have been concerned about the fact that you've changed your style a little bit over the years. But I think that part of it was that getting control of his own songs and doing it in the way that he had matured and the things that he had learned about the instrumentation, the expansion of his band, and eventually getting people like Pee Wee Charles involved, you know, all of that is laid out in front of you. Why not go back and get great songs that you wrote?
Well, that makes perfect sense. And it did give him a chance to use the tools that were not available to him in 65, 66, and 67, either because the tools didn't exist in those years or because UA didn't have the budget to provide them to him at that time. And let's face it, recording in the mid-60s was very different. It was still kind of this corporate mentality and union rules with the engineer so that you could be doing the best vocal of your life. And someone in the control room says, oh, break time, and shuts down the microphone and the mixing board. And you're standing there sort of dumb and happy, having no idea that you've been shut down. So this is really a perfect time for him to do that, because by the early 70s, artists got their hands on the tools.
Well, and also that's exactly right. And I think that it's not just the tools and what's available to him, but he knows from the concerts that he did through the early 70s, he knows what the audience is responding to. So, you know, there's another chance to where, you know, if you went to those early concerts, then you're going to hear Canadian Railroad Trilogy and so forth. So that, why not get it onto to a record during your peak popularity? So very smart move on his part.
We mentioned the audience response, Glenn, and this is a good place to mention this. What we are going to be doing today is going to be looking at things that were maybe commercially successful for him, but they were also things that he had re-recorded because album one was entirely redone. So he had a chance to reimagine them to some degree or another. And I don't have the statistics on each of the singles that we're going to be talking about on album one, although that information is readily available. But we are going to be focusing on the re-recorded songs. We're going to be comparing them to the original studio recordings, and we're not really going to talk about the live recordings very much because that's an entirely different kettle of fish. So with that, Glenn, shall we go ahead and jump in?
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm Not Saying, which was the very first thing that most people heard when they listened to Gord's Gold. I've got to admit, though, I like the original recording of this song better than the redone version. So from the Lightfoot album that came out in 66, I thought it was more of a wholesome production. Before the extra music and the extra instruments, the extra arrangement was put in, and the strings in particular. Now, I understand why it was there, because it was part of a medley, and you had to find some way of connecting these two songs in a way that made sense. But if I had to choose between the two of them, I would choose the original over the re-recorded version for I'm Not Saying. So what was your thinking?
Very similar. I'd look at it a little differently, only in the sense of there's no question that I prefer the original. And what we had to do, and I tried to do in my mind as we prepared for this, is even though I'm Not Saying was part of a medley, I tried to listen to it separately. What if Lightfoot had recorded that in its entirety for this album?
Yeah, me too.
And so, because that's not the only way you can do it, because, you know, I'm not big into grading, well, should he have put those two songs together and how was the transition? You know, that's great for concert fare, but I think I'm too much of a purist to worry about that. I was looking at what would this have sounded like if he had done the whole thing. And I really think the original would be the preference, because I'm Not Saying is it's one of those folk songs. You know, Peter, Paul, and Mary picked up on Early Morning Rain. They could have just as easily picked up on I'm Not Saying.
Oh, I absolutely agree with you. It's just that good. It's as good a song, every bit of it, as Early Morning Rain. And they are kind of two peas in a pod. I mean, the imagery and the vocal style. But it sounds like we both kind of land on the original version of I'm Not Saying.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
Sanjard, look!
Yes, Zac? Wait, what's that thing you're holding up?
It's a time travel device. We can use it to go back to the past and watch movies.
But we already do that on our podcast, Oldie But a Goodie.
No, on previous episodes, we were pretending to time travel. Now we can do it for real.
Cool, so we can really go back to like the 80s or the 90s?
No, Sando, you're thinking too little. I mean, we could go really far back. Like we travel back over 100 years into the past.
Oh, but Zac, that's so far in the past. Those movies would be old.
Yeah, but, well, a show is called Oldie But a Goodie, so we should probably do old movies.
Oh, that's a good point.
That's right, folks. This year on Oldie But a Goodie, we're going back further than ever before.
Wait, who are you talking to?
We're starting in 1920s, doing one movie from that year, and then moving up to 1921, and we're continuing that until the year 1969.
Nice.
Join our time-traveling journey through cinema by subscribing now to Oldie But a Goodie out wherever you get your podcasts.
That's Not Gunnan Productions podcast.
Hey, do you like classic albums? Technically, like, the, you know, the 20th century albums, such as, like, Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones. I've only had Beatle episodes so far, however, I'll be doing more. But, welcome to my show, or rather, hey, welcome to check out my show. All those years ago, a classic album podcast with the dipping sauce. As you can see, the George Harrison reference. I review classic albums. Not of those, the likes of Beethoven, the likes of the Beatles and Rolling Stones, and like I mentioned earlier, or what have you. So yeah, check it out. It's every Monday. I do albums, conspiracies, songs, all that jazz. So just check it out. All those years ago, a classic album podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.
Moving on to Ribbon of Darkness, I have to admit I have not heard the Marty Robbins version, but I like this version, the one from Gord's Gold, better than the original. I thought it was more stylized as a country song. I thought the pace was brisker, and I thought it was danceable, for lack of a better word. It was a nice idea to have it as the other half of the medley with I'm Not Sayin'. Now, I'm not going to go into whether or not we think the songs go together lyrically or philosophically, but I will say here and now that the Gord's Gold version takes the cake for me. What do you think?
Well, I agree in part on this with your sentiment about this, because I loved when you, this is one where you definitely need to listen to the Ribbon of Darkness in that part of the medley, because it's really well done. I mean, it, and I think it's not just the pace. It's just everything about it, the way the instruments are used and all of that. And I think they did more with it than they did on Lightfoot, the 1966 album. But for me, it was different. Because I was a Marty Robbins fan from the day that he did El Paso on, even more than me being in tune with Lightfoot, I was in tune with Marty Robbins first. So I was very aware of Ribbon of Darkness. The first time I ever heard Ribbon of Darkness was Marty Robbins' country song.
Well, and that makes sense because it was a number one hit, if I'm not mistaken, for Marty Robbins. Now, that's a story for another time to compare the versions of that, but I don't know that there's anything else to say about that song. So let's move along here.
Yeah, what's the final thing I'll say about this? I'm not sure, because Ribbon of Darkness was so significant for Marty Robbins, I'm a little surprised that Lightfoot didn't give it a full dose. I don't know why he put it in a medley. So that's my only question about it.
Well, I think the only reason that it was, well, I don't know because I wasn't there, but that it was included was so that people would understand I wrote that song. That was me who did that. That wasn't Marty Robbins who wrote it. That wasn't somebody in Tin Pan Alley who wrote it. That was me. I think about Paul Simon when Bridge Over Troubled Water would be sung by Art Garfunkel. In concert, Simon's attitude would be, while he's sitting in the wings, he'd say, "Hey, I wrote that song. Thank you very much." So I think that was a little bit in his head, and I think Gordon is entitled to defend his own creativity. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah, you're on it.
Song for a Winter's Night. Again, here I have to say that I think the remake is better than the original. I think the vocal is a lot richer than the one that was done earlier, and I love the effects. I thought they were really cinematic, and they really brought me into this cabin in the woods with the lamp burning low and the fire dying, and the jingling of the bells at the very end. I can remember Deb Radwan pointing this out to me, that the jingle bells, if you listen to this recording, are getting closer as the song fades out, because the idea is that the singer's love is arriving rather than leaving him alone in this cabin of the woods in the middle of the snow. So this version of the song was just much more enveloping, immersive audio, if you will. What do you think about this version of Song for a Winter's Night?
Well, cinematic, panoramic, and I would add the phrase new age. Almost ahead of new age, well before Enya, well before Celtic Woman, well before Sarah McLachlan. This song is something else. It's hard for me to explain exactly how much I love this version on Gord's Gold. I mean, it's not that the other version isn't great, but this goes into the stratosphere for me. And I have a phrase because I try to be a Renaissance guy a little bit, and I'll listen to some classical music over the years. And my favorite in that arena is Mozart. So I give it a tag, Mozart worthy. When I hear either a Beatles song or a Lightfoot song or even Don McLean, you know, whatever that could have been turned into a symphonic project. And this song certainly hits all of those notes. I think you get the idea when little weird things like Wichita State University in Kansas records this in a Christmas program. And it's a knockout. Let's just say that Lightfoot just wrote an absolute masterpiece. It's right up there with If You Could Read My Mind. And it's way up on that list. A++.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we can both agree that this song is just a universe away from the original recording. And I think we can both agree also that it's certainly more encompassing than the original was. Speaking of encompassing, we get along now to Canadian Railroad Trilogy. Listening to this one from The Way I Feel, and then this version, I would say it's a draw. I could listen to either one of these and really, really enjoy them both. I like the coffee house texture of the original recording. It's obviously a lot simpler. It's a lot more accessible if you're not a music nerd, meaning if you're not thinking about the orchestration and what about this instrument and what notes will this play and how am I going to harmonize the other thing. The Gord's Gold version is, again, more cinematic, more evocative, more sweeping. When I used to play this song in my own gigs, I would always refer to the one on Gord's Gold. So between the two versions, for me, I'm going to say draw.
Well, you're probably right on there. I am biased here because you have to realize for me that Gord's Gold was the first time I really heard this song. It's kind of like your first love. You've got a situation where I had to really get back in time to start to appreciate the original one. And I agree with the aspect of it being a coffee house song, because not only coffee house, but Let's Do This Live. He does it great both ways. So your call on the draw, I can't dispute that really. I would just say that I'm biased because of everything that Lightfoot learned between 1969 and 1974 about recording, he brought to both Song for a Winter's Night and this song. He made them really glow. He took it from a great acoustic, classic folk songs to a higher level. It's just so well done. I can listen to any version of CRT just anytime. I never get tired of it. His ability to capture history and to do it in such a poetic way, man, what a songwriter.
Amazing songwriter. And as a historian and a history teacher and getting to teach the railroads as much as I do, although not the Canadian roads specifically, I can resonate with a lot of what's being said in the song, even before I knew the historical significance. When I had John McLaughlin on in the first season, he and I sat down and really dissected the parts of the song, the historical parts and the vocabulary and all those things, because I really think it's his best long song. I really like it even more than Wreck of the Edmunds Fitzgerald.
You're listening to Carefree Highway Revisited. We'll be right back after a word from a podcast partner or two.
We Radio is so much different than it was in the 80s. We had it all. The music, the movies, the DJs, and morning shows. Back to the 80s Radio is a show from the 80s in podcast form. We bring the memories from that awesome decade back. Join Toscano and Chang every Friday as they take you on a ride back in time, sharing their experiences and laughs. Stop on by and discover some of the wacky things this crazy duo comes up with. They talk about it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly of the greatest decade. Don't miss the greatest 80s podcast in the world. Back to the 80s Radio.
Is that song really a cover? What instrument are they playing there? What do those crazy lyrics mean? If you're the kind of person who thinks about stuff like that, you're in luck because I've got just the podcast for you. How Good It Is chooses a single song each episode and takes a dive into the story behind the song and the artist who made it famous. I'm Claude Call. You can find me in your favorite podcast software or just point your browser to howgooditis.com. How good it is.
The next track is Softly, and I don't like the original by comparison. I don't dislike it, but to me, there was a samba feel to the original that I didn't care for. And I thought that there was some unnecessary percussion in the original version of that. So the recorded one is my pick, although I do believe that one was a little overdone also. I thought there was too much pedal steel on that one, just my opinion. And I thought there was a little bit too much with the guitar harmonics, you know, bing, boom, bum, boom, bing, boom, bum, boom. But I would say that I do like it much better than the original at the end of the day.
Well, I'll take the alternate view on this. I like the original better, but maybe for different reasons than you might think. It's based on one single thing, and that is the vocal. The vocal on this, I don't disagree with some of your criticism of the original, but the vocal for me is so strong on the original. And you can only capture that in a moment in time. And it's not that we don't love Gord's voice in every iteration and every decade. He adapted. But I think that Softly, and you hear it a little bit when you hear the Sunday concert version too, is very similar to what it sounded like on that recording in 67. So I think that based on the vocal alone, I like that. And I like the fact that I'm a sucker for just a pure ballad. And it's things like even Jane Oliver covering Pussy Willow's Cattails and even changing the words. But her voice was pure and high on that. And I actually compared the two songs, Pussy Willow's Cattails and Softly, kind of in the same vein as the way Gord sang them back at that time. So based on the vocal alone, it's close for me. But I would give the edge to the original based on the vocal.
Okay, well, then we got a wash there. No problem with that. For Lovin' Me, the original recording to me was too twangy. I thought it was a little hokey. I liked the musicality of the revised version. I thought that one, though, left out some of the best parts of the lyrics. Now, they had to make a production choice. I get it. It was part of a medley. But the best part of the lyrics to me is, maybe someday when your poor heart is on the mend, I just might pass this way again. And they left that out. But it's a nasty song anyway. So although it is not a song that is a favorite of mine and not a favorite of Gordon's by the time he passed away, I'm going to have to give my vote to the re-recorded version for that song.
This one was really close for me. I'll probably vary, and I would probably move towards the original a little more for only one reason, the fact that it was part of the medley. I had a hard time. I kept trying to listen to For Loving Me within the medley to think, wow, if he had recorded a full version of For Loving Me, how different would it be from the original? I think your criticism is legit, though, on it did come across as countrified on Lightfoot in 66. Not to slight Gord on that at all, but I mean, if I'm going to go back in time and listen to a version 65, 66, I'm going to listen to Peter, Paul, and Marianne. I like what they did with the song, and I appreciate now the fact that this song has not worn well And I know Gord was not a fan of it, and I totally understand that. But you have to think about how long I followed music, and I've listened to The Wanderer from Dion, the Rover songs from the Brothers Four. I mean, this idea of a rover, whether it be a man or a woman, I mean, it's just, there's rovers out there, okay? So, and I always think of Better Angels. I felt like Gord at the time, I took it as almost like sarcasm, you know, to where this guy's, is he really serious about this? So anyway, who knows? But maybe Gord was not being sarcastic since he feels so bad about it. Or felt so bad about it.
Well, on the other hand, I don't think he felt bad about the royalty checks that he was getting from Elvis and so many other people, although I would never want to accuse him of just writing songs for a money trip. Far from it. Did she mention my name? Again, I like the original better on this one. The lyrics are more complete. I think the vocal arrangement is better. And the reason I say that the vocal arrangement is better is that although Gordon was not well known for duetting with people, I think he may have overdubbed the vocals, or maybe somebody in the band was singing harmony. There was no harmony on the Gord's Gold version at all that I can remember. And so to me, the original felt more complete. They left out some great lyrics in the medley, but also I just think it stood alone with the completeness of the arrangement. And that sort of brings us to the end of album one, side A. Any thoughts on that before we flip the record over, Glenn?
Well, I think that Did She Mention My Name? This song should have not been part of the medley, in my opinion. I think it was strong enough, and I totally agree with you on your assessment. The original is clearly the one. And that shows up on that CBC special when he did it. He even introduces the song, and here's the third song from my new album, and man, they nail it. I love the original. I play that album a lot of times, and that's the side I play. I would have loved to have heard him in 1975 do a full version of that song. It didn't need to be part of a medley.
I agree with you. And we won't debate the choice of being part of a medley or shortening it or what was left off. But I think we can agree that there's pieces missing when it shows up on the recording that was made in 75. Okay, so we turn the album over, and the first song that people hear on side B of album one is Affair on 8th Avenue. Now, we should acknowledge right here that that was left off of the CD version because there just wasn't room back then. They didn't have the digital capacity, and now I'm sure they could probably get 20,000 songs on the head of a thimble. So I'm going to let you have first crack at this one and at the rest of the ones on the album. Which one to you was better, the original or the remake?
The remake, for me, it's close. And I think when you and I talked about doing this, I told you that of all the songs that really got my attention on the remake side, this was the one. There was just no doubt that CRT and Song for a Winter's Night, they were great songs. This one just took on a whole new thing for me. And I kind of compare what he did on Affair on 8th Avenue on Gord's Gold. It's a little bit of the same New Age resonance approach that you get with Song for a Winter's Night. I think those two things, I can almost play them back to back, and I'm still in the same mood, and it's a good mood, okay? And I think that, I guess what he had learned over time and the way he assembled the studio musicians and what was put together, it just really worked on Affair on 8th Avenue. When I have to listen to one or the other, I'm going to listen to Gord's Gold on this one.
Yeah, me too. But I also have to say that it's a wash between the two for me. I can't decide between them. I think the Gord's Gold version is more true to the spirit of the song, and I also think there's a level of emotion that didn't exist in the original. But I have to say I like the vocal in the original as well. It was more fresh. It was not as weary, not as experienced. I'm not sure what the right word is, but it seemed closer to what Gordon was thinking when he wrote the song. So this one, I could go either way.
One other thing on this, that if you were going to make any case for the original, again, it might have been, even though I detracted the same things you did on Softly, for the same reasons, his vocal on Softly and his vocal on this one, it's great. But there's other mitigating things about how well this was done on Gord's Gold. Again, I give that one the edge in this case.
Well, that wraps up part one of this interview that Glenn Nelson and I did about Gord's Gold. I'll let you know when the second half is going to be posted. In the meantime, run for the roses, but don't forget to stop and smell them. See you later.